Go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy to get 20% off your first month of cognitive behavioural therapy, with weekly sessions online with a therapist, in addition to worksheets, a journal, meditation and yoga videos, and unlimited messaging. There's strong evidence that CBT can help people who hoard, and accessing therapy online can be affordable and accessible. Find out more and get your discount at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/spoken today.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. I am drowning in stuff and trying to find a way out. Listen as I explore the issues and delve deep as somebody profoundly affected by hoarding disorder. Find out more, including links to subscribe to the podcast and all of my social media at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. Finally, I am not a doctor. I am just a hoarder doing her best. So do seek professional support if and when you need it. So I am here with Dr. Jan Eppingstall, a counsellor in Australia who specialises in working with people who hoard. She has a PhD in hoarding and is an all-round superstar. Jan, how are you?
I'm very well, and I'm just bowing as you've introduced me and said I'm a superstar, but not quite the superstar that you are.
Oh, bless you.
So I'm just, you know, I'm just here as a support, as a scaffold. That's it.
I love it. Can't think of a better scaffold. Marvellous.
Excellent.
So a lot of people believe that hoarding must be pretty easy to diagnose, that it's quite a self-evident condition. But it's not actually true that all people who live in overwhelming clutter and don't know how to get out of it are necessarily hoarders in the true sense of having a diagnosable hoarding disorder. There are actually a range of other conditions that can cause hoarding-like living conditions or hoarding-like behaviours, and the way to approach them can vary. Sometimes applying treatments and techniques designed for hoarding disorder will be really helpful, and other times they just won't be relevant at all. So, Jan, first of all, why is it important to understand exactly what is causing behaviours that look like hoarding?
I think with any psychological phenomenon, there's a need, particularly as clinicians, to focus not only on the behaviours but the reason behind them, because often the behaviours do look similar on the face of it. But unfortunately, if we assume we know why someone is behaving a particular way and then begin treatment without clarification, we can actually inflict unintended harm. You know, harm's harm, whether we intend to or not. And if we go down that path without being curious and asking those questions and finding out the reason behind the behaviours, we can we can go wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. So what are some of the other conditions that can cause hoarding behaviours that aren't the same as hoarding disorder?
The conditions that usually come up are, you know, obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, obsessive compulsive personality disorder, OCPD, or depression, the neurodivergent conditions like autism spectrum, attention deficit hyperactivity disorders. But just as an aside, I kind of want to say here that I don't consider either autism or ADHD as disorders. I'm just doing some air quotes.
You are. I can see them, listener.
Good. They're differences, not a problem. But they are actually currently listed in the DSM as such. So I think that's a bit of a controversy that we'll, you know, tackle later on. But the other area is the other types of conditions are acquired brain injuries, including dementia, chronic substance abuse, poverty, intermittent homelessness. All of those could, if you look just at first glance at the physical manifestation of clutter, you might think that it's hoarding, but there are just so many things that can appear that way.
And in this episode, we're going to talk specifically about depression, about obsessive compulsive disorder, autism, ADHD. But as Jan has said, this is not an exhaustive list. So we're going to start by looking at OCD because, first of all, because a lot of people still believe that hoarding is a form of OCD. What is OCD in a nutshell, and how can it cause problems that might look like hoarding?
So OCD is a chronic and lifelong disorder in which a person has uncontrollable reoccurring thoughts or obsessions and or behaviours, compulsions, that the person feels the urge to repeat over and over again in order to offer some relief from the obsessive thoughts. So it's an ego dystonic disorder, which means the person comprehends that those obsessive thoughts are not real, but they're unable to stop themselves from completing the ritualistic behaviours.
Powerless against them. Well, that's how it feels.
Exactly, because they go, I don't understand why I have to, you know, keep driving, turning around and driving back over that bump. It's so silly. Why am I doing that? But I have to. I just can't seem to stop myself. And it can appear to look like hoarding if we do look at that visual evidence only. You know, that is that presence of a large volume of possessions with no clear organizational order. But those with hoarding as a symptom of OCD may have difficulty discarding due to more likely a specific obsession or fear. Like they may not want to discard due to a fear of contaminating themselves or others. They might struggle to discard because of superstitious thoughts about letting go of that object, like something bad might happen to a loved one if they discard it. Another one that can overlap in hoarding, but I think it would be more intense in OCD, is that feeling, those feelings of incompleteness. That's one that I hear quite often. I feel like if I let that go, then something will be incomplete. And saving to maintain a record of all life experiences is another thing that's seen in hoarding within OCD. And this is where some people may save bodily products. I don't like to say the horrible, yucky words, but sometimes they'll save, you know, hair or nails or whatever other sorts of products or rotten food. They may not, if they have OCD, they may not feel like they can let anything go, anything that has come from their body or as part of them. Or when they attempt to discard, that triggers endless rituals like washing or checking.
Yeah, checking, right? That you're not throwing something away that you shouldn't with the things that you should.
With the things that you should, yeah. So they avoid the discarding because then they can save the time. Yeah. You know, they don't have to go through all those rituals of checking and, you know, maybe washing their hands or wiping down the object or whatever it is. So then that just means they just save it as a result. Yeah. and they avoid it completely. But perhaps the clearest way to identify if it is hoarding or OCD is whether the person, A, enjoys acquiring and feels comforted by having their possessions around them, B, if they're emotionally attached to most of the stuff, and C, they save items mainly because they're beautiful, valuable, or they might be useful in the future. If they do these things, then it's likely to be hoarding disorder. It's not likely to be OCD, because people with OCD, as I said earlier, it's ego dystonic. So they don't feel comfort by having those possessions around them, opposite to hoarding, where that is part of the disorder, and that attachment, the emotional attachment to most of their stuff, that's more hoarding. OCD, they're going to have, there's still sentimental attachment to things, some things, but not the same level of attachment to most of their objects. So that is the way you can kind of distinguish the two.
So what's the difference between OCD and OCPD, obsessive compulsive personality disorder? And can OCPD be hoarding related as well?
Ah, yes. Okay. So I've got the word salad. So OCD is a mental disorder with symptoms that cause marked anxiety to the person and can increase while under stress. And this inhibits their ability to function in the world in any normal capacity. But OCPD is a personality disorder. So personality is that enduring aspect of our individual differences. It tends to dictate how we think, feel, react, behave in particular situations. And although it's stable over time, we can learn and evolve. It's not fixed as such, but it tends to be quite stable. So if someone has a personality disorder, they're kind of unable to react flexibly and appropriately to life challenges. So it's this kind of set of rigid or extreme traits. And OCPD, the diagnostic criteria, is actually based on Freud's anal retentive character. It's just like cut and paste pretty much. So a personality that has that preoccupation with orderliness or parsimony or frugality and obstinacy, you know, rigidity and stubbornness. So it's all, they've basically kind of gone, that's a particular personality type. We will now have that in the DSM. So, you know, in 2023, we see those with OCPD as people who are preoccupied with control, perfectionism, and organization. So for a very long time, hoarding was considered a subtype of OCPD because one of criteria was an inability to throw out useless or broken objects because that was seen in presenting cases. Now, this criteria remains in the DSM today. I don't know whether it should remain there, but it does, which is really, really interesting. So what I'm going to talk through now are the criteria that are in the current DSM for OCPD. And just have a listen to them and see how they fit, how you think they would fit with hoarding. Because there are some things that will, but the first is a preoccupation with details, rules, lists, order, organization schedules, to the extent that the reason for the activity is lost. So you spend all this time organizing and then you don't actually do the thing that you've planned to do. Perfectionism that interferes with completion of tasks. Your own strict standards are not met. The third is excessively devoted to work and productivity to the exclusion of leisure and friendships. Four is over conscientious, scrupulous, and inflexibility about matters of morality, ethics, and values. Five is unable to discard worn out or worthless objects, even when they're no sentimental value. Six is reluctance to delegate tasks or work with others unless the delegate does exactly what they say to the letter. Seven is adopts miserly spending towards self and others. Money is something to be hoarded for future catastrophes. And eight is shows rigidity and stubbornness. So there's some things in there. Like you probably kind of nodded at that first one, like that whole, you know, I'm going to spend all this time and I'm going to plan what I'm going to do. And then, oh, it's 10 o'clock at night. I'm tired now.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Or that perfectionism. You know, I have to get this exactly so.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, what's the point? So I get that too. And that over-conscientiousness, the scrupulosity around waste and I mean, they've got here matters of morality and ethics and values. Well, that all encompasses, I think, what hoarders feel about waste. Yeah. So there's definitely overlap there.
But also I can think of a lot of people who would fit those criteria. I feel like a lot of people who are maybe successful at work are quite, you know, fit a lot of those, tick a lot of those boxes. And it feels quite drastic to call that a personality disorder when it does fit a lot of people, doesn't it?
I know. And that's the thing. And we've just kind of highlighted there the number of things that, you know, possibly overlap with other elements in other disorders.
Yeah.
So it's all a bit of a mishmash of symptoms and signs that don't necessarily, are not exclusive to one particular disorder. So it's kind of, it makes a little bit of a fool of some of us because we like these labels, but really it's all about, you know, what the purpose of the behavior is, what the behavior is and how you, and the needs that are underneath that. But OCPD does tend to be, like hoarding, egocentric, which means we see these behaviors as part of who we are. You know, I'm the type of person that ...
I make lists. I plan.
I make lists. I'm a list maker. I'm a planner. Whatever. Exactly. Yeah. So they're likely to feel that they're right in those actions and thoughts and feelings. And chances are then they don't believe they have a problem.
Yeah.
It's not a problem that I do these. Yeah. And those with OCPD tend to work themselves ragged, trying to meet these unrealistic standards that they've set for themselves. Now, that could look a couple of different ways, couldn't it? That's quite broad. It could be in a lot of areas of their lives. So it's a tricky one. I don't hear many people diagnosed with OCPD.
I don't either, because I suspect a lot of psychiatrists fit those criteria and so like to go, oh, that's not real.
And also, you know, they're the markers. A lot of those are the markers of what we perceive in society as being successful humans, don't we?
100%, yeah.
People who plan, people who spend all their time working hard.
They're meticulous, yeah.
Meticulous, exactly. And they don't want to delegate because, you know, if you can't, you know, if you have to do it yourself, no one else can do.
Yeah.
Do it as well as you, all that sort of stuff. That's kind of what people look for in a good employee. So no one gets diagnosed with it. I think the worn out and discarded and worthless objects kind of sits there, doesn't it? It kind of doesn't feel.
Yeah.
I don't. I think they've tried to kind of slip that in with the whole frugality angle and the scrupulosity or something. I don't know. It just doesn't sit that well with the entire disorder.
So there is OCD, there is OCPD, and there is hoarding. Mm. And they can also combine. Like, I have a diagnosis of OCD that is entirely actually unrelated, as far as I can tell, to my hoarding, because it was a bit of a mess, the diagnosis, because the form of OCD I have the compulsions without the obsessions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite unusual. And so the psychiatrist was mostly excited to have found somebody with this particular formation of OCD. And then when it came to like, yeah, but what can I do? He said, to be honest, he said most of the treatments like for OCD focus on challenging the obsessions And that reduces the compulsions. And so because you don't have the obsessions, there's nothing to challenge. So there's not really much we can do. So I felt like we came out of that meeting with him quite pleased with himself for having found a rarity, and me no better off than I had been, other than having a name for this thing. And my compulsions are thinking based. It's ritual thinking things.
Ah, right. Okay.
It's not counting, but it's that kind of thing.
Okay. Right.
And so I have that, and I have hoarding disorder, and I feel like they're not connected at all. But you can have, you know, two or three of those, and they can be connected. How can somebody work out what's going on in that kind of respect?
It's super tricky, but it's all about that predominant problem. Like in your case, I can see that these two things are quite separate. What I usually focus on in the hoarding cognitions and thoughts and things are those things that are driving the behavior, the reasons. So, you know, I'm looking at, as I'm talking with the person and I'm observing and listening to their answers, I want to know if they're emotionally attached to their possessions. That's like the number one thing.
Yeah.
Do they feel that excessive responsibility for the welfare of their objects? And you can hear that pretty quickly as you're working through the initial sort of assessment. Do they think their memory's poor, so they need to keep things to jog it? Or do they like to keep things out in the open so they can see it? Do they excessively anthropomorphize objects and acquire and save on the basis of being kind to inanimate objects? Clutter may cause them distress, but does the saving cause them distress? No. Well, then I would be saying, yeah, that's likely to be hoarding. So I can kind of separate that out and say, okay, those things. Then I'll look at organization. So can I see any extreme levels of organization within a home? And with some areas in disarray, like maybe they have a particular focus, like the office is amazingly, immaculately organized, and then there's sort of a jumble everywhere else. Maybe they have like an exceptional planning and goal setting routine, or they're hyper organized and perfectionistic at work, but at home, you know, has become overwhelmed because of a new stressor or responsibility or loss. So then if that was predominant, I would kind of say, okay, I think that's OCPD. I think there's, you know, some personality, like controlling sort of personality that's going on in that case. You know, if the person's emotionally attached and anthropomorphizes and is also rigid and perfectionistic with an overwhelming need to control, then maybe they have both. Like maybe it is both OCPD and hoarding disorder. But I haven't seen this as yet. In fact, it could be the other end of the continuum where individuals actually suffer anxiety and stress because they have an extreme urge to throw stuff out and can't keep objects because they have that aversion to clutter or imperfections in their home. So that kind of what has been kind of called compulsive Spartanism, it doesn't really have a name, but that's the name I've seen. There's no research on that phenomenon as yet, but I can kind of see how those two things were definitely, you know, and it's impacting their life because every time they go to get out the blender, they've thrown it in the bin because that the blender they don't use every single minute of every day. So the urge to throw it out was so strong.
Yeah, yeah.
That's possible. So if it's hoarding within OCD, you know, there's likely to be that significant distress about the behavior and that kind of bewilderment as to why they can't let go of stuff. Like, why? I don't get it.
Hoarders know exactly why they're keeping things. Yeah.
And they've got more than one reason, right? They've got a bulk of reasons and they'll go, and this and this and this. And you'll think, okay, well, that's logical, right? And they won't have emotional attachment to many objects, you know, other than that regular sentimentality.
Yeah.
And then that ritual, those rituals around checking or cleaning that hold them back from discarding, either because they spend hours doing the rituals or they just avoid discarding completely.
Yeah.
So that's when I would kind of go, okay, I think that's OCD. I don't know how likely it would be to have a combination of all three. It could, though. You could.
Nothing's impossible.
Nothing's impossible because if you had the OCD, it could be around contamination and you throw things away or whatever, you know. There is a chance. I mean, look, hey, everything's possible.
Never say never.
Never say never.
The listener voicemail segment has a monthly theme to help you think of something to say. For September, the question for you to answer is, what's the hardest thing for you to get rid of? For some people, it's nostalgic items. For others, it's books or food or clothes. This is your opportunity to share your hardest things with us all. Have your say with your voice. If you want to record a voice message for me to potentially play on a future podcast episode, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/voicemail and leave a message. The topic for September is the hardest thing for you to get rid of. Let us know what you're thinking at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/voicemail.
So depression is another mental health condition that can lead to living in a situation that might look to outsiders like hoarding, but doesn't involve the same emotions and thoughts. You often hear people talk about a depression nest, which can be mistaken for hoarding. So how can clinical depression cause symptoms or behaviours that look like hoarding?
So if you've ever suffered from clinical depression before, as I have, you'll know the lethargy, the insomnia or hypersomnia, you know, that brain fog, hopelessness, helplessness, and you've got, you're just not finding pleasure in things that you enjoyed before that you used to find
Everything
fun.
Feels pointless.
Exactly. Everything just feels like what's, why, you know, just getting out of bed is like an Olympic event. And then having a shower is exhausting. If you can't take time off from work and you're in that place, you need to kind of plaster the mask on and pretend everything's fine. And it's just exhausting. So when you get home, I mean, you don't care about the pizza boxes and the coffee mugs and the bin because you're worthless anyway, right? You know, you don't deserve a tidy house or an organized house. It'll just get messy again and no one cares about you. No one's visiting. Yeah. So you just give up. And in these cases, usually the person doesn't feel attached to all these things. They've lost that impetus to maintain their space. And they will usually let you tidy up for them without distress. You know, I don't say without shame, though, but without distress. They'll kind of go, if you're someone who's close to them, that, you know, you'll be able to grab that plastic garbage bag and just fill it, you know, and they won't feel distress.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what that kind of, and I think the depression nest is a good kind of descriptor because it just sort of builds up around you, doesn't it? It's just, and it's not a protective layer so much as kind of a pointless, you know, it's just everything's pointless. It just builds up.
There was an artist years ago called Tracy Emin, and her artwork was her basically what we would now call her depression nest. It was her bed with all the stuff, her unmade bed with like cigarette packets and ashtrays and, you know, just all kinds of junk around it. And it was one of those pieces of art that made people go on the news endlessly saying, what's happened to art if we think this is good and all of that. But it's so, I'll find a link to it and put a link in the show notes because it's an evocative thing.
Because just as you were describing it, it's kind of, I really get that I really get that art because it just, it's an expression of those emotions that are internal. That they just and hoarding is the same, isn't it?
Yeah.
But for different reasons. Yeah. And I think it is, you know, if the person can, you know, allow someone to come and clean up in inverted commas, then chances are that it really is that, you know, it is sinking into that deep clinical depression.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm just finding a link so I can show you live.
I love it. I love it.
Isn't it great?
Oh, I love it. And I have seen so many of those.
Yeah.
So many of those. I think it's awesome. Oh, yeah, I really like that.
You can imagine the, you know, the white male dominated art world having absolute kittens.
Oh, it's great. It's great. It's and the vodka. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Ah, I'm feeling her pain.
Aren't you? Yes. You know exactly what she was going through. Yeah.
Really do. You kind of go, I know exactly what's happening. Yeah. Yeah. That deep sort of just hopelessness and just helpless. I just will lie here and I'll smoke and I'll drink. And maybe something will change in between now and when I wake up.
Yeah. Is there a chance that somebody with depression and an extremely cluttered home due to their lethargy and misery and inability to get out of bed could develop essentially hoarding disorder and end up with what I tend to call hoarding thinking that kind of exacerbates the problem? Or is there always a clear differentiation?
I think that's like a really, really good question. And it's one I don't know the answer to. There's no clear kind of directionality between depression and hoarding, like whether one comes first and is followed by the other or the I think if you're in a deep depression for a long time and you stop making decisions about your stuff, and as a result, you know, your default becomes indecision and overwhelm. I think from a logical point of view, it's possible. I think there's the evidence isn't there yet to tease that out, but I can see that happening over time.
Yeah. I think my thinking with that question was like somebody who goes on a diet and then really likes all the compliments and really likes the sense of control and ends up with an eating disorder. And that wasn't what they started with, but they kind of found something in that that they went, oh, that helps.
Yeah. And that might be, you know, okay, having the stuff around me feels good.
Yeah.
That's one thing that makes me feel good. Therefore, yeah, yeah, yep.
And so if somebody's wondering, do I have depression or do I have hoarding disorder? How can people tell whether they have one or the other, or again, both? It's not like it's impossible to be depressed and hoard.
Oh, and it's very common. It's one of the most common co-occurring, disorders with hoarding. The thoughts about possessions and reasons for saving are usually there from a young age in like that hoarding mindset. So they'll be able to remember having trouble letting go of things perhaps as an adolescent. And time is what contributes to the severity in many cases. But an episode of depression may be the first time the person hasn't kept a clean and tidy home. So untreated and without support, and as you've just said, if it is something that is giving them some comfort, you know, having the things around them is giving them some comfort, that could become hoarding thinking. And that indecision and brain fog can just make saving and acquiring kind of that default. I'll just go for that. Acquiring gives me a little bit of a tiny dopamine hit, enough to sort of get me through the day or whatever. But then when I get home, the lethargy, the pointlessness of everything just means that, it means that I'm just living in clutter. I don't know that I'm not sure if I mention it later on, but bipolar disorder, you know, you've got the highs.
In which you might buy a lot. There's a lot of excessive spending, isn't there, if you're in a high.
And that can be, you know, devastating for a person because they might be on a high for a long period of time and they've bought all this stuff and it's just overwhelming them. And then they dip into that depression.
Crash.
And you're living. I had a client many, many, many years ago who was bipolar, and her bed, you know, the new clothes and things that she'd bought were up to the level of the bed. So it was completely, the whole room was completely one level. And that was, and then she was in a deep depression and she was unable to even just get out of bed in order to deal with the stuff. So in that way, I can see that the depression and the using purchases to kind of give you that lift can be problematic.
And also, while we're not clear whether depression can, whether clinical depression can lead to hoarding disorder, I think it's fairly clear that hoarding disorder can lead to depression.
Mm. Exactly. Yes. Yes, definitely. Right. And it's, it co-occurs just,
yeah, you know. Your situation feels unmanageable. If you get to the point where you start to see this isn't okay, but you don't know what to do about it, or you're overwhelmed by it, it's so easy to just sink into misery, isn't it?
Mm, exactly. And you, and it's so hard to lift yourself back up out of it, particularly when often we're very isolated with hoarding. We are a very isolated population. And not having that, you know, that support one-on-one with someone else or, you know, a close friend or family member, it's so easy to stay down, isn't it? Stay down deep in that depression without having that connection of someone that you can rely on. And that the idea that when we're with another person, they help us regulate our nervous system, being in the same room as someone. Yeah. And when we're not having that, like during COVID, that was a real eye-opener for a lot of people because they weren't used to being completely alone all the time.
And even like I've had friends who are very depressed and I have said, I'm coming over, I'm going to make you a meal, I'm going to make you a cup of tea, I'm going to put a load of washing in your machine, you know, and I could do that and they needed that and they appreciated that. If your home is hoarded, you would say, oh, no, don't come, don't come.
Mm, don't come.
So even if you have people, it, you know.
Exactly. And it's the shame. It's the shame that, you know, is getting in the way of functioning again. It's just I need this person and I know I need them and I can talk to them on the phone, but that's not enough.
Yeah.
I actually need to be in the room with this person to co-regulate. And that's what's so heart-wrenching, you know, for people who are really in this, you know, depression hoarding kind of situation, because what they need most, they're unable due to the sense of shame and anxiety to invite people in.
So whereas OCD and depression are mental health conditions, we are going to talk now about autism and ADHD, which are neurodivergences. People prefer different terminology, so we're going to mix it up. I have several autistic friends who prefer to be called autistic. Other people prefer to say they're on the spectrum or have autism spectrum. So I think if we use a term you're not keen on as a listener, we're not doing that to be offensive or upsetting. I think we're just trying to mix it up a bit. But as Jan said earlier, kind of avoiding the disorder side of that, because a lot of people celebrate their difference. They see it as an alternative way of being. Like they would prefer the neurotypical world to be a bit more neurodivergent in a lot of cases. It's not a problem in need of a fix. Other people are neurodivergent and struggle with it and find it really difficult. But diagnoses of both autism and ADHD are increasing rapidly as people realise that not every autistic person is nonverbal and exceptionally good at chess. And not everybody with ADHD was the naughty kid at school. I think we're getting a much broader understanding of both conditions and how they can manifest in a range of ways. And as public awareness of that grows, more people are being assessed. So let's look at autism first. What is autism?
So autism spectrum disorder, as you mentioned, you know, is to some people a disorder or a problem to fix.
Yeah.
But I think most of us now are coming around to that new perspective of seeing autism as a culture, like of its own. It's got its own cultural kind of norms.
Touch points, yeah.
Exactly. It's a developmental difference, and it's characterized by divergent social interactions, communications, restrictive and repetitive interests and behaviors, and sensory sensitivities. And this is something that has kind of dawned on me recently, that it's on a spectrum. It's not linear.
Yes.
So in the past, we've had this kind of idea of high and low functioning, and that's just outdated.
Like, I mean, it's 0 to 100 when it's not.
Exactly, exactly. Like, you're either here or you're here or you're somewhere in the middle. So it's autistic. An autistic person has a unique profile. Like, unique as a fingerprint. So there's all these areas. It's more like a kind of pie. So there's social differences, interests, repetition, sensory sensitivity. They have different ways of regulating their emotions, different perceptions. Their executive functioning is different. So it's kind of like that pie, and a person's profile on each area kind of varies. So they're really strong in one area, or one area is particularly relevant to them. Another area, not so much. So, yeah, I'm learning a lot about autism, and I'm working with a lot more autistic clients.
Yeah.
And that's why this conversation is really important, because just becoming aware that this is perhaps something that might be part of, you know, your makeup and your neuro universe, I guess.
Yeah.
Is really, really, I mean, we're in a day and age now where so many adults are being diagnosed.
So many, yeah.
And often, you know, often I'll have a client who says, oh, my son was diagnosed, or my daughter was diagnosed, and then I got diagnosed.
Yeah.
And it set off, you know, it just set off this chain of, you know, events of me learning more about why things have been so difficult, because neurotypical people have tried to, you know.
Contain.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
Tell me what was, you know, keep me in a box in a way that I had to conform.
Yeah. And how can autism get mixed up with hoarding disorder? What leads, first of all, to the similarities?
It can look like hoarding, because some people on the spectrum collect objects, and quite a lot of them do collect objects of a specific, often it's an unusual area of interest, and they actually enjoy classifying and organizing them according to particular dimensions and things like that.
And again, the stereotype is of a young autistic boy collecting like toy trains or cars or something and lining them up in a particular way. But it doesn't always look quite like that, but it's that kind of theme.
Exactly. Like I've had someone describe to me their daughter collected rocks, but it was gravel. Basically, it was gravel off their driveway, right? But there were different aspects and different kind of dimensions of these rocks, and her daughter would spend hours and hours and hours and hours just reorganizing them in her room on the ground, and she'd have a little pouch that her grandmother had made her, and she'd take them all out, and she'd be working through, oh, I'm going to do it this way now, I'm going to reorganize it this way. And that is something that those on the spectrum may do. It's often known as stimming, which is a way to reduce their anxiety and bring themselves back into kind of, you know, a comfortable space.
Yeah.
So that can be what they use their collections for. And they do often want to complete a series of things, or that, again, that they don't like incomplete.
Yes,
as well. So that this is something else that's come up in OC other areas, right? So it's like in OCPD. So yeah, so that incompleteness or OCD, that incompleteness is also in autism.
I think the two are often mixed up. You find people diagnosed with one and then ultimately actually diagnosed with the other because the first wasn't quite right.
Mm, exactly.
And what are some signs that somebody might have autism rather than hoarding disorder?
It's not always easy because I work with a lot of adults and often they've gone undiagnosed their entire life and they learn to mask many of their behaviors in order to fit in, and particularly women, you know. And that's why there's been this, you know, this idea that it's boys who are a particular way. But there's just so many women now, adult women, who are being diagnosed. And it's this masking of I have to do these things in order to fit in, because that was the only way that I would have been accepted at school, accepted by my parents, all those sorts of things. But one of the first things I notice is with my clients on the spectrum is that they're very literal and they take every word per the dictionary definition. So I actually had one client who was, you know, explaining to me in quite a lot of detail. She's not diagnosed, but her son is. She hasn't had the diagnosis. But we were talking about something and it was a word that she was, you know, that she'd researched the definition and she was very frustrated that everyone used it in the opposite meaning of what it originally was. So I'm getting alarmed, like my little radar's going off. I'm thinking, oh, that's interesting. Okay. In the home, the most obvious signs are that they tend to keep their collections quite organized and they're likely to actually interact with their stuff quite often.
Yeah.
And they'll recategorize, like I was talking about with the rocks. You know, they'll recategorize them, use it as a form of stimming, and that helps them to reduce their anxiety, calm them down, help them cope if they've had, you know, sensory overload or frustration or maybe even physical discomfort that can bring them back and they're able to concentrate on something else other than their bodies. The other telltale sign is the collection is usually very specific and possibly centered in some cases around a feature like the material that it's made of or the texture or the shape or color. So that can be something that like the bells go off as well and you kind of go, oh, that's...
like a sensory...
Exactly, like some sort of sensory collect, you know, it's a collection around one of the senses, you know, whether it's touch or, you know, or whether it's a color that they love or whatever. So it's not, look, it's not easy, but it's something that is becoming a lot more obvious to me and more people are looking for help. But of course, you know, with a neurodivergence, it's what we need to work with what we've got. This putting people in a place of feeling like they need to change themselves to fit in, be someone different in order to be accepted. I mean, those sorts of things are extremely exhausting and anxiety provoking and, you know, often traumatizing. You know, one of the things that I'm now realizing and taking much more on board is, you know, changing an appointment for someone, you know, say you have a regular appointment with them and they're on the spectrum and you've had this regular appointment and then something comes up and you want to change it the day before. Now I really I think really long and hard about that, whether I really have to do that, because that structure for some it's really super important and that's very, very you know, upsetting or destabilizing or sensory overloading if you change. Then others, it's not so much. So as I say, you need to be just constantly asking questions and learning more about what their kind of profile is super helpful. If you can get them to share, like I'll often ask them if they can share with me their diagnosis and the areas that are most difficult for them, because sometimes they can't, like sometimes they, you know, it's hard for them to describe it. And that way I can go, ah, okay, that's super important. I need to be aware of those things as I'm working with this person. I maybe need to slow down my speech, or I need to think about what I want to explain before I see them. So I explain it in a succinct, direct way, without metaphors, without, you know, you know, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I imagine from your point of view as a therapist, you have to always be looking for, is that person shutting down? Like, has this gone a bit too far? And if somebody is autistic, that shutdown might look quite different.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Totally. And you've got to kind of know. You've got to know, and you've got to be willing to ask and be curious about that. And once you are aware of it, it just opens up this whole new kind of relationship with that person.
Yeah.
Because you now get it. Now know that you need to say to them, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do that, and we're going to do this together. And then, you know, and be very specific about what's going to happen, because uncertainty and not knowing what to do in situations is, again, something for a lot of people, not just someone on the spectrum.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, particularly those with anxiety or social, you know, social anxiety, they want to know what's expected of them.
Yeah. I have a friend with an autistic son, and he hated his birthday, and they tried for ages to unpick what it was, and he didn't know and they didn't know. But anyway, they eventually worked out that he couldn't cope with the uncertainty of opening presents and not knowing what was inside.
Ah.
And so once they'd figured that out as a team, as a family team, what they all agreed was that as they handed him something, they would say, this is Lego, and then he could open it and have that moment, but without the uncertainty of not knowing what was in it. And for him, he now doesn't hate his birthdays.
Amazing. Amazing.
But it took them all to go, what is this? Because he couldn't articulate it, because he didn't quite know. But they got there. And now he likes his birthday.
That's amazing. And that is the thing. Often, you know, clients on the spectrum have said to me, I can't tell you how I'm feeling. Yeah. I just can't describe it. That alexithymia, that inability to describe the emotions or the sensations or feel. So that, again, not pushing people. And when they say, as you said earlier, you know, noticing when they're shutting down, it can look quite different, you know, with those on the spectrum. It's listening, asking the question, is everything okay, or do you need a break, or. And then they say, yes, I need to be alone. And respecting that they need to be alone. They don't want a glass of water. They don't want you to make them a cup of tea. They just want to be alone. That's it. That's really hard for neurotypical people.
Yes.
Because there's all these layers of, like, societal kind of pressures on what we think we are expected to do for others. And often all of that is just... it's just rot.
I feel like I need to say at this point, for full disclosure, I don't have a diagnosis of autism or ADHD. I feel like if I was assessed for either or both, on a Monday I might get the diagnosis and on a Tuesday I might not. I feel like I have a lot of the traits, but I don't feel at this point that there would be any particular benefit in seeking a diagnosis. So I just work with what I've got, which is some weirdness that may or may not be either or both of those things. But I was thinking also that I and a number of autistic people I know, you know, have special interests and a particular topic that for a while is all they can think about, and they know everything about it. And I would imagine that it's related to what you were saying about, like, the gravel and the rocks. But I feel like a special interest that takes over your life can definitely end up in amassing stuff. And then 6 months or 6 years later, there's a new special interest and you need to amass that stuff as well.
Definitely. And there is quite often I found everything out that I, yes. I've found out everything I can about that thing. And then, I'm over here now and I'm sweet. Yep. And that's right. And it's completely forgotten about. So whatever's been amassed, whether it's books on the topic or whatever, now I'm on this and that's now my focus. And that's really hard. It's really hard to then get that person to switch back to that old interest because they just don't, I'm not interested in that now. And I can see how that would be really, really hard to, to work on because that the switch is very black and white.
Yeah. Why would I be interested in dealing with that old stuff when there are fractions to learn or
exactly so whatever it is, whatever it might be. And it is, I think that and as you say, that can just look exactly like hoarding because it's just an amass of stuff that you're no longer actually interacting with. You used to be looking at it all day and now you're no longer and you're on this other path, so that can be quite tricky. And I can't say that I've dealt with that yet, but I think that there's a chance I will, in the future.
In a previous episode, I mentioned getting suddenly and deeply obsessed with elephants. And I got so many messages going, "Are you autistic, by the way?"
Maybe. Well, maybe.
So ADHD. Can you explain what that is, first of all, and how it can manifest?
Yes. Well, at least 5% of the population have ADHD, believe it or not. Similar to autism, successful people with ADHD learn to mask and adapt to the symptoms so the numbers can, they're pretty skewed probably. There's probably more than 10% of the general population that have ADHD. It's an array of traits, and they're unique to each mind.
Yeah.
And, they're all, as with ASD, they're all different in their presentation. But ADHD is a way of being in the world. It's not entirely a disorder or entirely an asset. It's kind of got a bit of both. Hallowell and Ratty, who just bought their latest book, ADHD 2.0. Dum, dum, dum.
Don't get out of date, ADHD. Get the latest ADHD.
Correct. they describe it as a complex set of contradictory or paradoxical tendencies. So each negative has a positive. But the telltale signs across someone's life kind of span is unexplained underachievement, which I like that's your naughty boy who's never sits still, a wandering mind, often off with the fairies as is oft said by our elder generation, trouble organizing and planning, that's our executive function, a high degree of creativity and imagination, trouble with time management and a tendency to procrastinate, strong will, stubbornness and refusal of help, generosity, restlessness, unique and active sense of humour, which I liked. I like that phraseology.
Yeah.
Trouble sharing and playing with others early on in life, but at the same time wanting to make friends, exquisite sensitivity to criticism or rejection.
I've heard that called rejection sensitive dysphoria.
And there's also recognition sensitive euphoria. So when they get recognized, they're really sensitive to it and they kind of grow bigger and like push the chest out. So, yes, rejection sensitive dysphoria, impulsiveness and impatience, An itch to change the conditions of life. So they're the ones that are trying to make those big changes in their own lives and possibly in the world. High energy, uncannily accurate intuition, transparency to the point of being honest to a fault. So they'll just tell it like it is.
Yeah.
They are susceptible to addictions and compulsive behaviours. And that's that itch of wanting to change conditions, and sometimes their impulsiveness leads to addictions and compulsive behaviours. Tendency to externalise or blame others while not seeing their role in the problem. And they do have a distorted negative self-image. That the whole ADHD thing, there's some more there that, you know, that we could talk about, but it's highly heritable, and if you have one parent with ADHD, the risk is 1 in 3 for a given child. But if both parents have it, the risk rises to 2 in 3. So, you know, if both your parents are, you know, attention deficit or hyperactive or both, then, yeah, the genetics are there. But other than that, environmental stressors can cause ADHD, like head injuries, a lack of oxygen at birth, early infections, those types of things. And, yes, trauma can.
I was just going to ask about trauma, yeah.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And there are people nowadays, which is very interesting, now younger generation, who have ADHD-like symptoms because modern life brings out something.
You don't have to concentrate for more than 3 minutes on a video because
exactly,
that's how long they are. Yeah,
that's how long they are. They've decided that they like the idea of calling it VAST, which is variable attention stimulus trait. And it's important that they say it's a trait because it's something that, you know, that is not a disorder as such. It's what you do in the environment. But the constant bombardment of stimulus, and I mean, our brain is just trying to go faster. We're slaves to instant gratification and constant stimulation. I mean, kids can't, like, my kids won't read, but one will, I'll give him that one, reads books. The other one, oh, that's boring. Oh, there's too many words on that page. I'd rather watch a video. It's like, oh, my goodness. So there is no disorder per se, but it is that trait driven by the environment that we find ourselves in. So, you know, even if you don't have, you know, ADHD, you might have those symptoms purely because of the environment you find yourself in. It can just show up like that because we're all in that space right now.
Yeah, you open your phone to use the calculator and you've got a notification from Instagram, so you check that. And then you go, oh, my friend's posted, I'll look at that. And you don't know why you picked up your phone.
Oh, I cannot say how many times I've done that this week.
The app designers know what they're doing. They know how to grab your attention and make you stay on their app. That's their whole thing.
That's their whole reason for, you know, being. It's, yeah. There's people out there making millions of dollars trying to suck you into their apps. And it's working. And we do.
Works, like, on me.
Oh, it works on me. I'll go to Google something on my phone. You know, I'll go, oh, I'm reading a book and I want to find out about that particular person or whatever. Because, you know, I can never just read the book, watch the movie. I've got to read every book. Yeah. I've got to watch every movie.
What else was she in? Let me just look that actor up because I recognize her, but I don't know where from.
Seriously, that is my modus operandi 99% of the day. But I go, oh, I want to look up a particular queen or something. I'm watching a TV show going, is this queen real? Who's Queen Joan, whatever? So I go to Google that, but I get sidetracked on some news article, and then I'm down that, and I'm down another rabbit hole, and down another, and then I go back to my book and I'm like, oh, I was looking up that person because I was reading it. Oh, wow. And that is just a loop that we're all getting ourselves sucked into that is just time wasting. Unbelievable. And it makes us feel like we're disorganized. We really, I feel that way. And then I've got the sense of shame that I wasn't able to stay on track and do what I said I was going to do. Spiral.
So Executive dysfunction is a phrase that frequently comes up when you read about ADHD. And a lot of it does apply to people who hoard as well. In my episode with Casey Davies, we talked a bit about that. And also Jan and I are going to do a future episode specifically about executive dysfunction and hoarding. But is executive dysfunction one of the reasons ADHD symptoms can lead to problems that look like hoarding?
Yeah, definitely. Executive dysfunction, and it's a big topic. I think it's right that we go deeper into that. And there's also, there's definitely some very similar problems in ADHD and hoarding. So they really kind of overlap, and it's hard to tell often whether that's, what is it? And often people will have a diagnosis of both because there is that planning, that impulsivity, the creativity, thinking of new ideas, all those sorts of things, all and the executive dysfunction related to planning, organizing, cognitive flexibility, all those sorts of things. Now, when we go through and talk about that, it's actually quite interesting because the research is very mixed regarding hoarding and executive function dysfunction. There's, you know, there'll be one article that will find definitely this is a problem and another article will find no, that's not a problem. So there are two or three things that are really worth talking through. But I think the thing is with hoarding is that a lot of that emotion impacts on the executive functioning, so it looks like ADHD, but that'll be worth talking about.
Yeah, you think I can't get started, that's executive dysfunction, whereas actually you can't get started because the pile you're meant to be working on is too emotional and you can't face it.
Yeah, you've opened a doom box and it's like, yeah. Oh no, I can't, no, and you can't seem to switch. You don't have that ability to kind of switch, and then you're stuck and you decide not to do it. So, yeah, I think there is some of that going on. So it's worth talking that through. That was something I did a lot of research on when I was doing my PhD. I did a whole chapter on executive dysfunction before anyone else had done a review. Why didn't I publish that? That was stupid. I should have published that. I didn't, and then someone else did. So. That's all right. It's all good. Share it around.
So as I said earlier, I don't know whether I have ADHD or not. I don't think I had the symptoms as a child, which makes me think I don't. But that's not particularly important. What is that whether I have it or not, I often find that tips and advice for people who do have ADHD are really useful to me too. So whether I've got it or not, I can use that advice. So Can people with ADHD benefit from advice that's aimed at hoarders? Can people who hoard benefit from advice aimed at people with ADHD?
Definitely. Look, definitely. I mean, currently we kind of don't know if the indecision in hoarding is, you know, structural, like a physical difference in the brain, like it is with ADHD, or is it Hebbian, meaning, you know, the neurons that fire together, wire together, that learned behavior. Well, whatever the case, indecision or inability to focus on boring or complex tasks, all of those tips and tricks offered by those with ADHD can certainly help. And the opposite. I mean, there's excellent references out there, books,
podcasts
like this one, you know, all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I definitely do think it's worth, and whatever might possibly work. And if it works, good. If it doesn't, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't you. It wasn't right for the place you're in at the moment.
That's absolutely my attitude to advice and self-help. And when I was younger, like, I would read a self-help book and go, well, that didn't fix me. And then read another self-help book and go, well, that didn't fix me. And it took a long time to go, okay, but that bit in chapter 7 was quite useful. So I'm going to take that forward. And then in the next book, oh, I quite like that bit, so I'll take that forward. It took me a while to get there, but now I'm very pro treating it like a buffet table and taking the bits that help.
Exactly. And then just creating your own sort of smorgasbord.
Yeah.
Like just I've got this, you know, all these bits and pieces in my toolbox that I can try. And look, if it doesn't work, it just wasn't right for me. It's not a failure if something doesn't work, because I do think a lot of these people out there who write self-help books, you know, it's often an area that they're very, you know, an area they're very good at. So they write all this stuff they have no, they need put no effort in to be good at that thing. And it's like, well, just do it. Just do this. And you're like, much rather to hear from someone who struggled a lot with this particular thing and found a way to get through it.
Just been trying to think of the logical fallacy that is. Survivorship bias. So they're good at it. So they think they're good at it because of the things they do, but actually they're just good at it.
Yes. Yes. Oh, that's a good, I didn't know that that's what it's called.
Yeah. Yeah.
See,
so
I learn
like
something from you every week.
If there's, say there's a car crash and a lot of people say, oh, it's a really dangerous road. And then there are people who say, well, I drive down. It's actually about being a good driver because I drive down that and I've never had a crash. And it's like, yeah, you think that because you've never had a crash. It's, you know, it's survivorship bias.
Definitely. And that is quite frustrating. You want your advice to come from someone who's really struggled with a particular thing. Had to like work hard at it.
Completely.
Not someone who just has a gift and like, this is how it goes. And sometimes I feel like some of the organizing books are very much that. It's beep, 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 pop, 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 and everything's beautiful. You know, and you think, that's actually does take a lot of, you know, cognitive functioning to get to that point. It's not something that everyone can do.
Yeah.
And, writing a book about something that you're exceptional at, just kind of like a giant pat on the back.
is great for people who are almost exceptional at it and want to go that final mile, but not for the people who are, like, if you're a good runner and you want to be a great runner, then a book by a great runner could really turn the dial for you. But if you've never run more than 3 feet for the bus, then a book by Usain Bolt will be no use whatsoever.
Yes. Soundbite.
God, I didn't know I felt as strongly about that as I clearly do.
Soundbite.
So although autism and ADHD are not mental illnesses, as we've said, people who live with them are actually more prone to mental health problems, especially depression and anxiety. And I think we've covered some of that in terms of people have to mask. People feel they have to mask their differences, and that is overwhelming and exhausting and, of course, can leave you very anxious. What if people don't like me, am I doing this right? Or depression, because you're so tired and you believe, you know, there's a lot of that. And then autism and ADHD can also co-occur, which is becoming known as on social media as ADHD, so AUDHD. So are there conditions or illnesses that are particularly known to frequently co-occur with hoarding disorder?
So interesting. A recent study found that up to a third of psychiatric inpatients were found in this study to have clinically significant hoarding. They hadn't brought it up.
That's not why they were there.
That's not why they were there. It was added in to, you know, the suite of questionnaires, and up to a third. I'm like, wow, that just blew my mind.
That's mind-blowing.
Blew my mind. The other thing, a study found that a group of hoarding participants that had co-occurring depression and ADHD, inattentive type, reported more severe hoarding symptoms. They're the ones that find it most difficult.
The inattentive,
inattentive, ADHD, depression, and hoarding, because you've got you know, low mood, low energy, low motivation. You've got ADHD where you're scattered and you haven't got good planning skills. So you come at the hoarding from this place where, you know, the odds are stacked against you, basically. So, I mean, the thing with ADHD is that it is treatable with medication. You know, if you have a diagnosis of ADHD, there is medication that is very successful in treating it. And depression, well, that's another whole story of whether medication works for more than a third of the population. But, you know, if ADHD is something that you really feel that you have, it's worth looking at diagnosis and medication for that, because its chances are it will help with the hoarding. But other conditions that frequently occur, OCD, generalized anxiety disorder, bipolar, as we talked about before, that excessive buying and the high and then followed by the depression, social anxiety because you're, you know, kind of protecting yourself against the world. Interestingly, bulimia and binge eating, I understand. Bulimia, I understand, I guess, you know, yeah. It's similar. It's that filling a hole, yeah. filling yeah. a gap in your life. Gambling and definitely personality disorders, like lots of personality yeah. disorders are linked to hoarding. So there's lots of different things that co-occur. I mean, it is one of the most difficult disorders to treat because of the physical element of it and those co-occurring other, you know, all those other things that co-occur. But that doesn't mean it's insurmountable.
Diagnoses can be important to help people understand their problem and to help others treat them appropriately, especially where, like with ADHD, treatments are more evidence-based. However, I do also believe that diagnoses are not the be-all and end-all. And if somebody doesn't have a diagnosis or is waiting for one at the moment, they can still learn about themselves and test out different things that might help them, as long as they do so cautiously. Other things can people be doing if they're just not sure what's going on underneath their hoarding behaviours?
Yeah, I think talking about diagnoses, I mean, there's no biological tests or markers for these things, you know, for ASD or ADHD or hoarding. So that is why it's so tricky. I mean, I've said this before, but many of the criteria are same across disorders, and yeah. there's inconsistencies in the quality of assessments. And, you know, OCPD and ADHD, there's a number of identical behaviours. And that diagnosis is kind of based on that bunch of questions, you know, that a clinician asks a person in an office where they're feeling, you know, anxious and they're only observed at a single point in time. So, you know, an inexperienced clinician using those questionnaires might not see the body language, the eye contact or lack of, or the tone of voice. Or
I used to get, when I was in mental health services in a more consistent way, I would, you know, see a psychiatrist periodically. And whenever a psychiatrist moved on and was replaced, I would get a whole new diagnosis. And they would go, oh, you've not got that, you've got this. And I would learn all about it. And then they would move on and someone else would go, oh, you've not got that, you've got this. And I got to a point where I thought, some people clearly do have a very clear diagnosis. I think something like bipolar, for instance, can be quite cut and dried. You know what you're dealing with. Other people, and basically with me, ultimately, eventually somebody went, well, this is obviously PTSD. And everybody went, yeah, this is obviously PTSD. And that one stuck. But before that happened, it made me realize how subjective a lot of this is. And if you get a psychiatrist who doesn't believe in a particular diagnosis, or who believes every young woman who self-harms is borderline, you know, then it's so subjective. And I'm not downplaying. I know people can feel seen when they get the diagnosis that fits. And I know that getting the right treatment is invaluable. But if you're like I was before the PTSD diagnosis, where one person says you've got bipolar and one person says you've got this type of depression and another person says you've got that type of depression, and you just think nobody knows what they're talking about, or I have 12 things, then that doesn't have to stop you making progress.
No, exactly. And I do have a client who has 11 diagnoses. Look, so many of them overlap, and I'm like going, wow, that is just absolutely crazy. And you're right, it can be comforting. And if it's something, look, it's often a way to get the help that you need.
Completely, yeah.
So you've got to kind of weigh up the pros and cons of all that. You know, I think that's important to weigh up. And other times it's shame provoking. You find out you have something that you just completely, you know, and you can't cope with that. So each person needs to weigh up those things. But I think if you're not sure what's going on underneath the behaviors, it's really important to kind of ask, you know, ask yourself some questions around, you know, try and self-awareness kind of gives you that clearer picture before you go to see a professional. Because as you said, it can be very, you find from one person you get this diagnosis, so you learn all about that. And then you go away and someone else goes somewhere new and they give you a new one. If you're able to kind of be more self-aware and ask yourself some of the questions that might highlight why, the reasons behind the behavior, that gives you, you know, it gives you a kind of base to go on before you go and see a professional, because we're not all, we're certainly not always right.
You shook me, Shan.
I know. We're certainly not always right. We certainly make errors. And also, as you said earlier, one day you might, you know, we're different people on different days, and we're different people, you know, in different environments, contexts. So a diagnosis, it is really better for a clinician to look at what are the behaviors and what are the functions of those behaviors. What are the difficult things that you're attempting and what are the functions of those? And if we come back to that, then we can see where we're in a loop and we're just looping around and around and around. And the only way to do that is to, you know, find out what's are you emotionally attached to the majority of, really think about that and sit with that, you know, do you really feel like the possessions are kind of an extension of you?
Yeah. Would you let somebody come in and just throw it all out for you?
That was my next thing. How would you feel if someone came into your house right now and said, you have to throw out, donate, or sell 75%? How would it feel?
Would you be relieved or would you be terrified?
Exactly. So there, you know, those sorts of things can really, okay, I'd be relieved. Okay. All right. Well, that tells you something.
That's a depression nest. Okay.
Doesn't, that's a depression. Exactly. Terrified. Oh, okay. That sounds a lot more like hoarding. You know, and then going through those sort of questions, whether you feel like you're a walking ghost, or, you know, do you feel like you don't deserve a clean house? Well, there's a layer of depression, and it might be both of those things.
Yeah.
You know, are there rituals that you avoid?
Yeah.
You know, is your savings, you know, you save stuff and you just can't comprehend why, you know, and do you have maybe some other OCD kind of compulsions in other areas as well, like you were saying? So, yeah. But for the kindred spirits out there, the questions of, do you spend hours planning your life down to the last second and then never get anything done? Put my hand up. Do you feel out of control when you let someone take over a project and micromanage them to death? Yep, I got my hand up. Do you like things to be aligned at right angles? Yes. Does your perfectionism stop you from starting to organize?
Oh, yes.
Yes. So, you know, those, if it's or that kind of stuff. Well, there's an element of that there. But what we were talking about earlier was pulling things. So once you've kind of got a little bit of a sense of your almost your profile, if you like, what are those things that are in the loops that you're just looping around? Once you've got an idea of that, then you can you've got your banquet and you can just pick which bits work. But I do think that if it's, if there is some sense of autism or, you know, if you've had that sense that eye contact is difficult or, you know, even painful, those sorts of things, do you collect and interact with this collection and move on quickly, those sorts of things, perhaps there might be, and it depends on how difficult yes. it makes your life. I mean, that's yeah. the whole point. How difficult is it? And if it's super difficult, okay, let's think about that, because there are a lot of supports, particularly in Australia, there's a lot of supports for those with autism. So it might be worth going down that path, but it's expensive. You know, you've got to have a full assessment, which can cost, you know, $1,500 to $2,000. And you may not even need that. You may just need to recognize that those are some of the things that hold you back.
And read a book about it. Yeah.
Read a book about it, you know, and that might be, that might be enough.
And also, I hate that we have to play this game, but I think medics don't like it if you turn up and say, I read on the internet about OCD. I think I've got OCD. I think they then go, they roll their eyes and try and disprove you. Mm. Whereas I think because certainly within the NHS in the UK, initially you get referred to whoever has a free space. And so you see whichever psychiatrist. But it might be that in that conversation, you say, I wonder if there's an OCD specialist you could refer me to, because there are some traits maybe, and I think it's quite interesting, and maybe there's a question. And I hate that we have to play that power game, but we kind of do, because there's a lot of arrogance in medics and they don't like being told things. So if you let them think they've worked it out.
Especially by a woman.
And, it might be that you need to be referred to an OCD specialist, psychiatrist, or an ADHD assessment. Certainly here, there are now dedicated kind of pathways for an autism assessment or an ADHD assessment now.
Yeah, we're the same.
So it might be, that you just say to your GP, please, can you refer me for an ADHD assessment? And that might be that. But if it feels more complex, and if it feels like you do think you've got OCD, but it's not a typical presentation, something like that, I think it can be worth, especially if you live in a city, there are psychiatrists with special interests in different areas, and they can refer between them. And if you can get that to happen, I think that's more fruitful.
I couldn't agree more. And you may be able to find a researcher who's particularly interested in your presentation, and that might lead to not a formal diagnosis, but it might lead you down the path where you kind of understand yourself better. And most of them, I tell you just a secret, most of them, if you find their, university email and you send them an email, I reckon about 65 to 75% will reply, perhaps higher.
Yeah.
So don't be shy and try to be succinct and clear about what your interest is in their area of expertise. But seriously, they will reply.
So tune in next month when we are going to be talking about executive function and executive dysfunction. In the meantime, Jan, if people want to find you online, where can they do so?
Yeah, it's a good question. You can trot along to stuffology.com.au, sign up for the newsletter, which is a weekly Sunday afternoon / night publication. You can just send me an email. I will reply, jan@stuffology.com.au. On the socials, Instagram, at @stuff_ology, on X. Am I calling it X? Twitter, X. I'm @stuff_ology. Or on Facebook, check me out at Stuffology Consulting.
Jan, thank you so much. It has been a joy.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to join you on the pod. May we take a moment to reflect on the meaning of place and acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we record and listen to this podcast today. I am speaking on the lands of the Boon Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation, and I acknowledge their connection to country, both land and sea, and culture. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
Do you want to be a dehoarding darling? You can be now at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/darling. If you love the podcast and want a bit extra, you can finally sign up to subscribe. Members will get an exclusive monthly post with an additional top tip, some podcast and music recommendations, and a personal update from me about how things are going. Find out the full details at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/darling.
Now on Broadway, An Enemy of the People is a New York Times critic's pick. Jeremy Strong is one of the great actors of his generation, hails the Chicago Tribune in a performance the Wall Street Journal praises as powerfully affecting and bitterly funny. Michael Imperioli sets off sparks, cheers the Hollywood Reporter. Victoria Pedretti is luminous, raves variety. From director Sam Gold and playwright Amy Herzog, An Enemy of the People is urgent, electrifying, and haunting, declares USA Today. An Enemy of the People on Broadway through June 16th only.
Hey, everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So my top tip today is also a shout out for the How to Fail with Elizabeth Day podcast, which is an excellent listen. And she, in this mini clip, is talking to singer-songwriter Lucy Spraggan about having compassion for yourself. Have a listen.
That idea that you've been trying to prove who you are your entire life, how's that journey for you today?
Well, based on a response from that quote, it's, I just don't feel like I have to prove anything anymore to anyone, because I feel like I'm always trying to just, it's not about proving anyone, it's just about finding out. And I'm constantly just finding out more about myself. And every day I feel more compassion towards myself. And that's where I feel like you start to win.
Yes.
Like more compassion, less competition. I don't feel like I have to prove anything. Some days I do.
Yeah.
Some days I'm like, oh no, I'm worthless. And other days are easier. It's not binary.
That's beautiful. More compassion and less competition with others, but also fundamentally with yourself.
Yeah.
So I will link to that in the show notes. It's well worth listening to on a regular basis, I would say, especially if you have a big fear of failure. Okay, thank you for listening, and I will speak to you next time. Thank you for listening to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. You can find more online at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. You can find me on Twitter at That Hoarder and on Facebook at Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder. To find out more about how you can support the podcast and the overall project, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/support and do subscribe to the podcast to make sure you don't miss any future episodes. There may be links in this podcast that earn me money. This doesn't come at any extra cost to you if you ever make a purchase through the links, and it helps to support the future of the podcast.